Welcome to the Klamath Tribes podcast. Ken Smith today talking with author Ferris Jaber of the book Becoming Earth, How Our Planet Came to Life. I read the review in the Wall Street Journal, and I said I must talk to this gentleman. He lives in Portland, Oregon, and today he's on the phone with us to talk about this wonderful book that I've read and that he's written. Ferris, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's just back up a little bit to, what are you, a scientist or a writer or both? And what's your background in environmental science?
Yeah, I'm a science writer. So I write for the general public about nature and science. I studied a mixture of science and the humanities in college, in particular life sciences. And then I did a master's degree in journalism, focusing on science and environmental reporting. And I've mostly written for, you know, a variety of magazines and newspapers over the years. And this is my first book.
What was your first writing that you did as a journalist?
Well, it goes really far back, actually, because when I was around 12 years old, I started writing short pieces for my local newspaper in the Bay Area in California. And then I was also working for my high school newspaper and college newspaper, but I didn't really start doing professional journalism until after college. And I've always roamed widely within the life sciences. So everything from biology and ecology to neuroscience and health, you know, basically if it involves living organisms or living systems, then it's interesting to me.
Did you work at a newspaper, magazine? What was your first gig?
My very first job was as a reporter for New Scientist magazine, which is a UK publication that also has offices in the US. And then I was an editor at Scientific American magazine in New York. And then I went freelance so that I could really focus full time on writing. And I became a contributing writer for the New York Times magazine in 2018.
You went freelance. You left a Scientific American magazine as an editor, which is a pretty good paying, stable job. And then you said, if I really want to be a writer about what I want to write about in science and in the environment, I have to be a freelancer. How did that start out? I mean, that's a challenge and it's intimidating, right? You got to make a lot, you're doing it on your own.
Yeah, it was a big transition for sure. You know, the issue was that there really aren't very many full-time writing jobs, staff jobs. You know, there's a lot of reporting jobs where you have to write many, many short news stories very quickly. And there's a lot of editing jobs where your primary responsibility is to edit other people's work. But most full-time writers are actually freelancers. They're self-employed freelance individuals because there just aren't many full-time staff positions that let you write long pieces. So I decided to make that jump to freelancing. And it was definitely a big and difficult transition at first. And it took a long time to sort of build up, you know, the right contacts and kind of get to a place where I could focus on writing long features and essays and then eventually books.
What was your first book?
This is my first book, Becoming Earth.
This is your first book.
Yeah, this is my first book. It was a 6-year journey. So from writing the proposal for the book to actually publishing it was about 6 years. And that was preceded by a few years of, you know, kind of intermittent research and thinking and writing and kind of, realizing that there was a book there and kind of putting the idea together. So it was a really long process. It's a book that takes an explicitly global perspective. So there was a lot of travel involved and a lot of in-depth reporting. So it took a long time to put it all together.
The writing aspect of it, how long after the research did it take you to write it?
Well, it was kind of, the 6 years was kind of simultaneous research reporting and writing because, I'd go on a reporting trip and I'd do a ton of research and reading for a given chapter, and then I have to come back to my desk and sort of synthesize that all, and then I have to do it again and again and again for every chapter. And so the bulk of the work is really a lot of sort of reading and intensive research and interviewing, you know, talking to a lot of experts and synthesizing their insights. And the writing is very intensive as well, but it, you know, it's a huge volume of information that you kind of have to digest and translate and synthesize, and that really takes up a lot of the time.
Well, there you go. That's what it takes to write a book like that. I mean, it's an all-encompassing book about Earth. I'll just read a little bit from your introduction for the audience. Becoming Earth is an exploration of how life has transformed the planet, a meditation on what it means to say that Earth itself is alive, and a celebration of the wondrous ecology that sustains our world. It's a book about how the planet Earth, as we've known it, how it is rapidly becoming a very different world, and how we who are alive at this crucial moment in the planet's history, will ultimately help determine what kind of Earth our descendants inherit for millennia to come. The book's three sections, rock, water, and air, mirror the planet's three main elemental components and its three major spheres, the lithosphere, hydrosphere, and the atmosphere. Their order further reflects their relative abundance. By mass, Earth contains vastly more rock than water and significantly more water than air. Each section has three chapters, the first of which examines how microbes, Earth's earliest smallest organisms, adhered to that layer of the planet. The second chapter in section focus on key transformation wrought by succeeding waves of larger, more complex life forms, fungi, plants, and animals, and how those changes depend on the ones that came before. The third reviews how our species has rapidly changed Earth in relatively recent history and investigates how best to reform our relationship with the planet. And quite frankly, you accomplish it in a very beautiful writing style, incorporating science with quality writing, your own personal views at times. We even talked about your garden that you started in at your house in Portland, Oregon, which was an interesting chapter on how you transformed a concrete, you know, yard into a flourishing garden. As you were writing the book and you got into climate change and even indigenous people in chapter 8 and how they managed fires in their history on the planet, that was interesting because we're dealing with so many fires now here. And as the Klamath Tribes is trying to do, incorporate their knowledge of how to use fire to create an ecosystem that's sustainable and resilient. That was a chapter that I was a little surprised to see it in there, but relevant.
Yeah, you know, the kind of ideas that I'm discussing in this book and that Western science has sort of been grappling with, you know, I wanted to make sure that readers were aware that there are very ancient antecedents to these ideas, you know, that Western science is certainly not the first to come up with them, and that it's sort of been engaged in this long process of coming around to them in many ways. And so I really wanted to make sure that indigenous histories, traditional ecological knowledge were, you know, woven throughout the book. And there's that one chapter in particular that you're referencing, which is all about fire and fire's role in the Earth system. And that narratively, that chapter focuses on an indigenous fire ecologist named Frank Lake, you know, who's done most of his work in Northern California. And I just found his personal story really inspiring and sort of relevant to the book as a whole, because, you know, he really believes in the power of combining indigenous teachings with the Western academic system. You know, he made it a point to persevere through that system and get a PhD and then, you know, work as a professional fire ecologist. And I just think it's really important, you know, something I was trying to do throughout the book is to continually put our moment in history in the larger context of the Earth's history. And so I'm really interested in sort of tying the modern current wildfire crisis to the entire history of fire on this planet, you know, and to do that, you really have to understand how life changed the planet, how life created the modern atmosphere, you know, gave us this oxygen-rich atmosphere, and then how plant life and fire co-evolved these incredible rhythms, and how humanity has both at different times, you know, learned to work with those rhythms or to severely disrupt them.
Yeah, you mentioned that Lake is a mixed indigenous European and Mexican heritage and a descendant of the Karuk tribe in Northern California. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Do you ever think of focusing on tribal use of the land and practices? It's, if you went around the America and talked to all these different tribes about how they managed in their different regions naturally over their lifetime and history, wouldn't that be kind of fascinating to get a grasp of how the Native Americans managed? Because you did the one chapter in this chapter 8, The Roots of Fire, and it got me to thinking, boy, a whole book could be dedicated to how Native Americans managed the land.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a completely fascinating subject. And when I was doing the research for that chapter, you know, I read quite a few books that, you know, where scholars have really looked into that. And, you know, they were focusing in particular, you know, one of the biggest kind of aspects of that is how indigenous peoples in the Americas and many other parts of the world use fire in particular to powerfully shape their landscapes. But of course, it's done in many other ways as well. But I was really focusing on the fire-related aspects for this particular chapter. But it's truly astonishing just, you know, how long these practices were going on for and just how profoundly they alter the landscapes. And then you have colonizers coming in and not even realizing at first that that's what had happened, you know, just thinking that the land was always that way, and that it was just there for the taking, you know. And people describe, for example, in the early Americas, the colonists encountering these sort of beautiful park-like landscapes where the spaces between trees are large enough for them to drive their carriages through. And this is, of course, because Indigenous Americans have made it that way, but they thought it was just that way always, and then it was that way for them.
I'll read a passage from that chapter, which our audience might appreciate, especially as this is a Klamath Tribes podcast. Lake remembered how the elders in his community had taught him that too little and too much fire were equally harmful for fish and other aquatic species. If fires were too small and infrequent, trees would crowd and parch the landscape, preventing rainfall from refilling springs and reservoirs. If fires were too big and destructive, there would not be sufficient vegetation to sponge up excess water or roots to hold the soil in place, resulting in more floods and landslides. In the aftermath of the Megrim fire, these ecological connections seemed to glow with new significance. Realizing how much more there was to learn, Lake decided to leave his job and return to school. And then you go on to his PhD environmental science work from Oregon State University. And he went mm-hmm. there. Yeah, we need more people like that, right? With the with a more in-depth perspective on how to manage our landscape, and especially with the fires so much out of control, we need more people like that. And we're doing it at the Klamath Tribes. We have our people here that are managing our lands that we purchase and changing, you know, brush, getting stuff out, burning to manage it. And that's the first time I came across that, was working here for the tribes and seeing that. So I don't think most Americans realize, you know, the usefulness of burn, you know, controlled burns, and its historical perspective with the Native Indians.
Exactly. We're, you know, most, I think, modern Americans are kind of embedded in this culture of fear when it comes to fire. You know, we still sort of think of it as something that's very dangerous, and that is a threat. And the, you know, the good aspects of fire, good fire is very much neglected in modern Western culture.
And your last chapter, Winds of Change, addresses climate change. And, I mean, how do you feel about it? Can we beat climate change, or is it just something that's not something we can fix?
I mean, I absolutely think that humanity as a whole, you know, we have the technology, we have the knowledge, we have the potential, absolutely, to rise to that challenge. You know, it would require a level of international cooperation and, honestly, you know, revolution, transformation of many of our fundamental systems and infrastructures, the way that we power our civilization, the way that we feed ourselves. So it would be a massive, massive global change, but I absolutely think that we are capable of it. The problem is that there are all these entrenched interests. You know, the way that the fossil fuel industry is just entangled with the political system, and it is preventing that progress. You know, we do see progress, amazing progress in certain sectors, like the way that renewable technologies have become so much more sophisticated, so much more affordable in many parts of the country and the world. You know, renewable electricity is now the cheapest form of energy, you know, and that's one of the biggest changes we need to actually persuade everyone to change over to that kind of energy. But you still have, you know, with example, for like with the current administration, this country, there just doesn't seem to be much hope for meaningful progress over the next few years. You know, there's still so many political obstacles to actually making the kind of relevant global change. But I don't, you know, I think it's important to distinguish that from kind of the underlying capacity, right? Like all the knowledge is there. We know what we need to do. I think that humans are absolutely capable of doing that. It's just, it's a matter of getting, you know, it's a matter of basically eroding and these immense political obstacles, and, you know, putting in the necessary social and political revolutions that have to take place.
You also talked about the Amazon, which one of the, you know, mentioned things you mentioned statistically was 15 to 17% of the Amazon has been cleared.
And if it a huge portion of the Amazon rainforest has been destroyed, you know, in large part for raising cattle and other kinds of agriculture. And if that continues, then, you know, the Amazon's self-sustaining rain cycle will eventually break, you know, because the Amazon generates about half of the rain that falls on its canopy each year. It also influences weather around the world, you know, so the rain that the Amazon generates is also having these atmospheric ripple effects on the water cycle right here in the Pacific Northwest and in Canada as well. So if we break the Amazon and break its rain cycle, then we start interfering with weather patterns all over the world. Some research even suggests that that would have an influence, you know, on California's Central Valley, which provides the, you know, a huge portion of the agricultural products for the whole country. So that's, you know, a huge risk right there.
You mentioned in it that some scientists that were doing the research said the tipping point is 25% removal of the forest. That's only 8% that we have to protect to just before it's cataclysmic.
Yeah.
And the way they're managing the Amazon, I don't see that. I see 25% as a very real thing.
Yeah, the good news from Brazil is that with their recent change in leadership, there have now actually been some reversals. You know, and the Amazon's doing a bit better than it was several years ago when I was writing the book. But you're right. I mean, the overall trend over the past few decades has been really bad, and it's way too close to that tipping point.
What's next on your slate now that this book is out? What are you working on?
I'm currently continuing to write features and essays for magazines. I'm working on some more climate change pieces. I was just in Australia with some scientists who are studying the Great Barrier Reef and sort of examining different ways to intervene and try to sort of delay its, you know, mitigate the bleaching that's happening and sort of delay its potential fragmentation. And I definitely want to write another book, and I have a lot of different ideas. So it's just going to be a matter of kind of researching those, developing them, and kind of choosing the right one for the second book.
How's Becoming Earth being received? It's got great reviews. I read it. I loved it. It was a pleasant, it's 200 and something pages, not too long. It finishes at 217 or so. but it covers a lot of detail. I mean, you get into some, you did some, there is so much information in this book.
There's a lot of information there. Yeah, it's true. And we've been very happy with the reception so far. It's gotten some really strong reviews, and it's now a finalist for both the Oregon Book Award and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. And the paperback's going to be out in April. So that will be a little more affordable, and, you know, it's a softer cover and all that. And I've updated the text as well, and there's now a reading discussion guide at the end for book clubs and such. And I'll be doing a range of events throughout the Pacific Northwest in spring, including a Science on Tap lecture in Portland, and an event at Broadway Books, and another one at Barnes & Noble in Hillsboro.
230 pages with the epilogue, and it's a must read if you want to learn about the planet we live on. And it's written in a manner that isn't too scientific, but gets the information out there. And it's beautifully written. Who are some of your influencers from former writers like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, going back that far? Who influenced you?
Yeah, you know, I fell in love with reading and writing through fiction. I was always reading a lot of fiction as a, you know, in my youth, in addition to sort of loving nature and wildlife and science. And then I studied English literature in college as one of my majors, and I really became passionate about the 20th century modernists. So these would be people like Virginia Woolf, James Joyce, Ian Forster, William Faulkner, a lot of stream of consciousness writers. And then it was a bit later that I started getting more seriously into nonfiction, and I'm really drawn to literary science writing and literary nature writing. So, you know, Annie Dillard is one of my favorites, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, you know, Rachel Carson, mm-hmm. The kind of writers who really, they have a passion for the natural world, but they're bringing this amazing literary sensibility to it as well.
I admire you because you've accomplished what I would have liked to have done in my writing career. It's not over yet. You know, I still have potential, but I went to Johnson State College my first year, and, you know, I was an ecology major, but unfortunately organic chemistry pushed me into journalism major. I was introduced to environmental writing in an environmental literature course, and mm-hmm. and that's where I fell in love with environmental writing, and that's what you're doing. You're the next generation of those writers.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Yeah, that's I certainly relate to that, and that is the kind of writing I really love as well.
Well, congratulations on an outstanding book, Becoming Earth, How Our Planet Came to Life by Ferris Jaber. An Oregonian writer lives in the city of Portland, joining me today on the Climate Tribes podcast. Thank you, Ferris.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.